Hello and welcome to another episode of Consumer, the European podcast of the Consumer Choice Center. I'm your host, Bill Wirtz, for the 13th episode of this podcast in studio in good old Luxembourg, and it's freezing outside. I know some people who have been off the Canary Islands in an effort to escape winter Europe, and I can't blame them. Go out and travel. Announcement: the Consumer Choice Center is hosting a webinar tomorrow, Friday the 19th, on the role of intellectual property rights in preventing future pandemics. Moderated by my colleague Luca Bertoletti, the guests are the Slovenian member of the European Parliament, Frank Bogovic, and the intellectual property litigation partner James Tunbridge from Venice Shipley. You can follow this live stream either on Facebook or YouTube on the Consumer Choice Center channel at 11 a.m. Central European Time. Hope to see you there. This is the episode of February 18, 2021. My guest this week is Carrie Halfaty Hardy. She's got experience in strategic communications, public affairs, and the non-profit sectors. I'll get into her bio later, but just know you probably know someone who knows her because she is everywhere. We'll be talking about the European Commission's agriculture roadmap Farm to Fork and its social, economic, and environmental implications. You'll hear the interview with Carrie later in this episode. Also in this episode, fake vaccines are being offered to countries, new border checks on the German border disrupt supply chains, and I'm joined by my colleague Jalasowski to talk about Uber laying out its defense for platform workers. So let's get started. The European Anti-Fraud Office, OLAF, is warning of criminal organizations posing as vaccine producers. These are scammers trying to either get people's personal information or money by surfing on the desire to get a COVID-19 vaccine as soon as possible. This is the European Pharmaceutical Review reporting, and I quote, "China's police have arrested more than 80 members of a group assembling and distributing counterfeit COVID-19 vaccines. In raids on several locations across Beijing and cities in the eastern provinces, the police seized more than 3,000 fake COVID-19 vaccines. According to a Xinhua news agency, the group had been filling vials with saline and selling them as vaccine since September 2019. It is currently not public knowledge how many vaccines were sold," end of quote. In the United States, the issue has already received more coverage. Here's the Wall Street Journal.
"Officials and researchers around the world are worried about the implications for public health and people's personal information. For instance, in December, the Department of Homeland Security said it had taken down a fake Moderna website, which appeared to have been used for fraud and spreading malware.
As it gets to be more broadly applicable, we feel the concerns for counterfeit and fake vaccines will be even more pronounced."
While Pfizer didn't respond to a request for comment, Moderna said its only sales have been to governments, which are working closely with medical providers to control and secure the first batches of the COVID-19 vaccine. So a legitimate vaccine is unlikely to be sold online by dubious sources. So far, U.S. authorities say that there have been no reports of fake vaccines being delivered to customers.
"It is very important to be vigilant online when you receive any kind of email that looks fishy, especially when it comes to this issue. Double-check the sender of an email and verify if it makes sense that the government reaches out to you for vaccination. Also, keep yourself up to date on the specific rules in your home country when it comes to vaccinations. It is very unlikely that you will be emailed from an @gmail address or that anyone will ask you for money to confirm your vaccine shot. At the beginning of the COVID-19 lockdowns, online retailers had to deal with loads of fake medical devices being sold." Here's Euronews reporting them back in April.
"Since most websites work beyond national barriers and products are circulating around the EU, European institutions are increasing the pressure on digital platforms to remove fake or misleading adverts.
Online shopping and platforms and media hosts have been contacted by the commissioner and are voluntarily implementing systems to stop fraud. They in fact have an obligation to do so, but they're being very proactive, I must say. I think that in one of the platforms they were reporting more than 1 million of these kind of things that they're taking down a day."
I doubt it's really the pressure of the European Commission that online retailers feel the most. I feel very strongly about retailers like Amazon needing to provide a good curation of its product line, the same as I would from a physical shop in the street. That's of course much harder to do online, especially if you want to have broad access. But in any way, the pressure should really come from consumers here. Compare products, research your purchases, and flag suspicious products and services to the platform if you think something's wrong. I believe that an active review mechanism is essential to have platforms and users work together to fight counterfeiters and scams, be that in a retail setting or in vaccines. In other news then, the ride-sharing platform Uber is presenting its defense of platform workers to the European Commission. Uber, as you know, being under constant fire in member states for its business model. I talked to my colleague Jala Sarsky to make sense of it all. Uber is defending itself towards the European Commission and says that platform work is work that should be recognized as such. Where do you think this is going to go? What do you think the challenges are in explaining to European policymakers that this is a, maybe for them, unknown business model, but it is certainly one that we should defend?
I think it's great to see that there's actually an alternative that is being proposed, and it is coming from the innovators in a particular sector. And we know that many European countries have dealt with ride-sharing companies like Uber in their own ways. Some have been very accepting and have generally allowed them to operate without too many restrictions, while others have essentially played along the part with the taxi cartel and making sure it's virtually impossible. At least here in Austria, essentially now they are treated as taxi drivers. They have their licenses as taxi drivers, and no one uses Uber anymore because it's basically now more expensive than using a taxi. So I think what Uber is doing and any other ride-sharing company in providing a different kind of model is obviously going to be better for consumers. I think this kind of third way is something that they had learned about in California. So if you remember, there's the large anti-contractor bill called AB 5 in California that did pass. And then there was a referendum to overturn parts of that when it comes to rideshare drivers, known as Proposition 22. And part of Proposition 22 was, yes, that drivers could be considered independent contractors, but it did stipulate that the company would allow for various benefits to be claimed by the drivers. And that model is very much what Uber has presented in their white paper, and at least provides a different kind of labor regulation that is not too burdensome, that still allows flexibility, and ultimately will mean that consumers will have more choice and will be able to try to use those better prices to get around.
I remember last time I was in Vienna, I was using the service Free Now, and I was talking to the driver to kind of find out what the model right now is. So just, can you explain, who does the driver, you know, somebody in Vienna where this conversation was big about, like, you know, what is their status, what is their employment status, who do they work for, and how does it work with the entire social security contributions? Like, who, how does it work?
So what we had very early on in Austria, and again, this is not a model at all, but in Austria, basically the requirement was that individuals could not just sign up to drive on the app, as is the case in many other markets. Rather, it had to be particular companies that had their own insurances, that had their own fleet of vehicles. And essentially any driver who was going to work for one of these companies basically worked for that company and then did the work for Uber. So it was a strange way in which individuals were not allowed to just show up on the app as a driver, which is probably the number one advantage for many people who use this throughout the world. And that made it very difficult for individuals to do so. There's a lot of different checks, more costs. Obviously, they will always get a certain percentage. You're not allowed to have your own car, so you're always using another vehicle and there are costs associated with that. So it made it very difficult. And I would hope that things would change throughout the bloc. But that model has really been the same in Italy and the Netherlands and other countries, is that there is always this focus on using these larger firms to contract out the work. And that's not necessarily in the spirit of what these ride-sharing apps are. The entire goal is to connect drivers with people who want rides. And the more loads of bureaucracy that we put in the way, the more barriers that we put in there, it means that that advantage that once was there as an innovative product no longer exists. So I would love to see more modernization. I would love to see, and I think all consumers would like to see, a model whereby they know that the driver will be paid. They know that there are particular benefits that are available to them which Uber itself is offering in many of these current countries now individually. And I know that has been in their white paper as to what they propose going forward.
And to conclude, what do you think is the best way to go about it from an EU perspective? Because the question now is, of course, when the EU legislate, is it better to have a harmonized system, or is it better for the Commission to come out and say, well, there are regional differences, there's regional preferences, and member states should do it in accordance to their own needs? Where do you come down on this part of the conversation?
I think it's generally in line with what the spirit of the European Union and all the institutions are, in that, yes, it is a block of member states, but recognizing that every country has its own particular culture, its own particular histories, its own particular legislation. And the best way to try to legislate as a block is not to provide ceilings or floors, whether it be on prices or services, but rather just to provide general guidelines that are very easy to follow. I think that is really the strength of much of the very good legislation that has come from the European Commission and the various institutions, is allow flexibility for member states based upon their situation. If we're talking about a place like France, which has a lot of tourists, they're going to have many different incentives when it comes to building these rideshare companies and legislation versus a country like Bulgaria, for instance. So that's a kind of flexibility that is needed. So the role of the European Commission should be to, yes, allow these companies to operate, allow consumers to use them, make the rules clear and simple, but don't impose any floors or ceilings, or generally make it too expensive to run, because that's the last thing that we need, is to add on additional costs that don't necessarily serve the drivers nor the users, and just price it out of the market so that we can't use it anyway. There's a reason that these companies are seen as disruptors, and they're very willing and open to following the laws and trying to follow a model that will work for everyone. But I think the EU, it's incumbent upon them, it's incumbent upon all of us who look to the EU or try to give some kind of influence there, to make sure that the laws, the regulations, the directives are going to be as general as possible. They're going to provide clarity. And that means that all of these apps can be better off, and we can have more innovation instead of more regulation.
In other news then, new checks at the German border with Austria and the Czech Republic disrupt supply chains. By early Monday, German border police had checked 10,000 people and caused massive traffic jams, leading the EU to react. EU Justice Commissioner Didier Reynders said in a statement about the EU's approach of leaving borders open, quote, "This approach is and remains the right one because it strikes the balance between preventing the virus from spreading further and safeguarding free movement in the EU. Unilateral decisions to close borders risk causing fragmentation and disruptions to essential supply chains and jeopardize the EU's internal market," end of quote. According to Politico, German Interior Minister Horst Seehofer responded by saying, quote, "Border controls in the heart of Europe are painful, but there is currently no other way to stop the virus." And he continued by saying, "We will return to normal as soon as possible," end of quote. I think it's hard not to remind people how terrible such a unilateral decision is for supply chains. We all remember some of the empty shelves from back in March and April 2020, and countries should really avoid this from happening. But no time to dwell on this topic, because I do have a guest coming up. My guest this week is Carrie Halfarty-Hardy. Carrie is currently consulting with her own firm, but she was previously with the American Hospital of Paris, the American Institute for Contemporary German Studies at the Johns Hopkins University, and also worked at the Cato Institute and the Texas Legislature. Carrie is fluent in whatever your language you'll talk to her, but for the purpose of this podcast, we'll stick with English. We're talking about agriculture. We're talking about agriculture and the European Commission's new farm-to-fork strategy. This strategy is supposed to reform Europe's agriculture sector and make it more environmentally friendly. In any way, here's the discussion we had. So farm-to-fork it's not legislation as such. This is important for the audience to understand. This is a roadmap of what the European Commission says where it wants to go. And it lays out some key policy objectives here. It wants to significantly reduce pesticides, and it wants to significantly increase organic farming. So this is like one of the two key pillars of what Farm to Fork wants to achieve. This is fundamental, Carrie. Have you seen
a region trying something similar? Because I have not seen an agricultural revolution this intense organized by a developed country.
First of all, no. And I think there's also a third leg to the stool, which is to change the complexion of protein, to move from an animal to a plant-based protein. And in a way that is absolutely unprecedented in history. It's changing the eating habits of human beings in a way that has never been done. So no, I mean, there is absolutely no precedent for this, unless you're talking about the Great Leap Forward.
Right, and I hope it's not going to go that way. And the thing is, the problem is, of course, the tools to reach these conclusions, and we'll talk about how we reach these conclusions in the European Union in the first place. But I mean, the tools to get there is also very questionable. This is something I've raised, is that, take the example of organic farming, for instance. So we want to increase to 25% by 2030. We're now, if I'm not mistaken, about 7% in the European Union. So that means that if we increase to that level, but the consumers don't buy organic, that's a huge social problem for the farmers, because if you can't sell a product to people, that crashes the price. I really think this is going to be having quite an impact.
Well, there's a couple of things to draw from the economic model. Is first of all, organic farming is less intensive farming, so there is a lower yield to the farming. If I'm drawing the numbers out of my head, but I believe it's 40% lower, or up to 40% lower. And so that means that you either have to convert more forest land into agricultural land, or you have to outsource, or you get rid of certain types of farming. Because we've seen in France, for example, with colza, when you got rid of certain types of pesticides, for example, or if people are trying to go to organics, you have a much lower yield, to the point where it becomes economically unfeasible. We had the same issue come up with sugar beets recently. That there was a problem with sugar beets, and if we're not allowed to do them in a traditional, conventional farming manner, then the yields become so low that the economic model no longer makes sense. So basically, you price the farmers out of the market, because they operate on very low margins to begin with. And when it actually costs them to do their job, obviously, they're no longer going to do it.
And the yield question is a social question, but also an environmental question. So the you know, if you need more land, more resources to do anything, that's a significant environmental cost. And the both the use of crop protection and new technologies of doing farming, the question is always about, like, what is the environmental impact? And, you know, and I think this is a fundamental problem as to how this is communicated. I'm just simply something as simple as a thumbnail on a news article. The way you portray farming, if it's, you know, with the large tractors on these American farm fields, and it's mass produced, it's massive farming, that's how it's portrayed. And then you compare this to the Swiss Alps with a couple of cows on the field. But one doesn't necessarily outperform environmentally towards the other. It's you actually have to do the calculation and all the factors, like what's your water use, what's your land use, and all of that. I think that's really what we forget here, and I think the European Commission often deals in stereotypes and banks on the fact that consumers do too, and I think more information is needed.
I think that in a sense, people, when they think of non-organic or conventional farming, there it comes up against what we would call in America the Jeffersonian ideal, sort of this agrarian scholar of people somehow very nicely dressed, overseeing abundant yields of farms where there's placid cows and very beautiful and very calm sorts of farming scenes. But it doesn't take into account the actual backbreaking work if you're going to do traditional as it was put in by the, I think it was the previous French agriculture minister, as the farming of our grandparents. The thing is that farming throughout its history has been characterized as being a field in which the workers have embraced technology. I mean, there was even a whole series on the BBC about the Edwardian farm and the Victorian farm, and it showed that as soon as anything came up that would increase yields or make the work lighter, people embraced it, because as you had, in order to be able to feed a population and not to have malnutrition, you needed to be able to produce enough. And I think that people are coming up between sort of a romantic, almost 19th century view of agriculture versus the way that we actually produce food.
Pesticides, when we talk about pesticides, the name in itself has such a bad connotation when we talk about it. I mean, you can't, to an extent, you can't have a rational conversation about how you need to deal with pests without, when you raise that question, having a lot of stigma to it in the first place, you know? And I mean, in a similar way, I remember when I wrote about this, there was a study at the University of Copenhagen where a significant amount of consumers thought that any fungal infections on their food could actually not be that bad because it's natural, right? And when you think about all the problems that we've overcome in human health because we use chemical substances in a precise way in order to avoid these problems, but now people think that the chemical substance is the problem because we've outperformed them. It's this anti-impact narrative. Like, we cannot have an impact on the environment in order to protect ourselves because that would be too selfish. It's really a fundamental, these policy proposals as a fundamental opposition to innovation. And I think that's really disconcerting.
Well, I think that there's another statistic to pull up is that it takes about 30 years for a population to forget catastrophe. For example, you know, we've forgotten about polio and how terrible it used to be. We've forgotten about tuberculosis and how terrible it used to be. Well, we forget about the terrible things that used to be able to happen to you when you ate bad food. People forget ergot. When you had this sort of fungal infection of rye, used to cause a really absolutely horrid disease in the Middle Ages. It was also likely responsible for the Salem witch trials. So you look at the kinds of diseases that can happen when you're not controlling either fungus growth or pesticides in your food. People have forgotten what can happen if we don't control them, because we tend to have a rosy view of the past. We remember the good things. We don't remember the bad things. We don't remember things. I mean, Americans would remember what was called Little House on the Prairie, the whole series, and they would talk about locust infection, locust swarms that would eat all the crops, and how they would be out in the fields, the whole family trying to beat them off, and they would lose everything. They would talk about different kinds of other diseases that would assail a crop, and people would lose everything. So they're not, this romantic view of farming pervades the modern day. Of course, we can have some lovely organic, and I have nothing against organic farming if there is, people who want to do niche farming, but we have to understand that that is not the norm and it cannot feed the world. And either we decide that we're going to come up with a mix that works, which will use new breeding technologies to allow us to increase yields without the use of pesticides, or we decide that we're going to let other human beings live in misery. And I don't think, and I think that's an absolutely fundamental and completely anti-romantic choice.
Yeah, the interesting thing is when you mentioned locusts, because there was a locust plague in the last summer in Africa, right? Very significant, a huge problem, exactly. And there, interestingly, in Kenya, it's the same like organizations that are now helping the farmers dealing with the locust plagues, and there is some international help towards that, is also the organizations that are calling for these countries to ban all the types of pesticides that they need to fight these, and insecticides, in order to fight these problems in the first place. We seem to be exporting our views on agriculture to Africa.
Well, and I think that that's actually a key component of the Farm to Fork initiative. It's that if we impose this viewpoint onto European farmers such that more European farmers decide to not pass down the farm to their children. Obviously, there's a lot of conversion now that farms are no longer being taken up by the next generation, because we believe that we can push this off to Africa or to the East or to Southeast Asia or South America or anywhere else where we don't have to see these problems. The problem is that by the same token, we want to forbid any kinds of pesticides from reaching Africa. Well, it's you know, it's a very privileged point of view when Europe, who managed to eradicate malaria in its own regions, pushed it off into, well, we stopped allowing anti-malarial drugs, or pesticides against the mosquitoes in Africa. And I feel particularly strongly about this because my daughter worked in Africa over a summer, and she ended up getting malaria despite the use of bed nets and despite the use of all the drugs that were supposed to prevent her from getting it. And it, you know, she was lucky in that she received medical attention right away, but it's a huge cost of life in Africa. And it's very, you know, and I find it morally rather reprehensible that Europe kind of pushes all of that under the rug, as long as it's not on the same continent.
And when we talk about innovation, because it's not just pesticides that help us manage certain agricultural problems, there are new technologies out there, one being CRISPR. This is a gene editing technology. This is where you don't insert new genes, but you edit the genetic structure in order to remove the things that are that you don't want in a certain seed. Here, the European Union is lagging behind us nationally quite a bit. You know, the Consumer Choice Center, we looked at genetic engineering regulation across the world, and we found out, of course, Europe is very far behind. Interestingly, Europeans having been involved in the discovery of this technology, now Europe not being able to use this technology, Emmanuel Charpentier, who got the Nobel Prize for this discovery. It's just so interesting, because here is an opportunity to create cheaper food, healthier food, and also help us reach our climate change objectives all at the same time. But something seems to come in the way, and it's the precautionary principle. And this is where I want to get your thoughts as well on.
Well, first of all, I think it really is a clash of societal views, whether we're going to be pro-innovation or whether we're going to be pro-caution. And with the precautionary principle, it means that we sort of back up where we don't have a good grasp on risk management. First of all, I think the precautionary principle is anti-risk management. It's not understanding the difference between danger and risk. It's not understanding the trade-offs that can take place. I mean, when you look at the case of CRISPR, you know, you have a French scientist who was forced to go to Germany to pursue her work. And yet, of course, as soon as she won the Nobel Prize, France started to do its usual coquelicot. And I say this as a French citizen, I find it absolutely appalling that here in the country of Descartes, in the country where we have such a deep and long and fabulous history of scientific progress, that somehow we've thrown this all by the wayside because we no longer believe in human progress.
Yeah, but here, and this is sort of playing devil's advocate, do we know enough about this technology? Is that because every new introduction of any new scientific innovation is always like, well, what could be the downsides? And could we only find out about the downsides 20 years from now, right? So what are the trade-offs? If we're fully transparent, we have to say that it is hard to know everything, and I think the zero risk promise is also also something that we cannot guarantee. And I think this is where politically it gets very difficult, because as a politician to say, "Hey, I'm going to be open to the self-driving car, and yes, there might be a horrific accident, but I think the innovation warrants the potential risk." And I think there as well is where we should put the finger on the scale and say, hey, this is something we need for all the challenges that we're facing.
Again, we can come back to a French thinker. We can come back to Frédéric Bastiat and talk about that which is seen and that which is unseen. Because we might say on the one hand that innovation has an unseen potential downside, but what we fail to see is that precaution has an equal potential downside. For example, look at the precaution that took place currently with the vaccines or with the approach to opening up the country in face of COVID. You look at the countries that more quickly adopted a vaccine strategy are also more quickly vaccinating and more quickly opening up. Regardless of what you think of this, the point is that there are trade-offs on both sides, whether you use the precautionary principle or whether you favor innovation.
So, and I think because we're coming to the end of this segment, I'm just sort of curious, and I ask this to a lot of the people who come on the podcast, how optimistic or pessimistic are you in this specific field? Is Europe lost on agriculture? Have the people who are nostalgic about agriculture won the argument and this is it? Or will we, no matter what the political argument will be, outperform our challenges with innovation no matter what? Where do you stand on this?
I want to stand on the side of optimism. I want to believe that that the saner voices will win out, that the countries that cannot afford the huge rise in food prices, the 17, 18, 20% rise in food prices that are predicted to go along with farm to fork, that those countries will discover their voice and that the politicians in those countries will discover their voice and push back against the wealthy countries like France and Germany that are pushing a model that will bankrupt their Central and Eastern European neighbors. And I think also when you see a competitive Britain off the coast of continental Europe, when you see the non-EU countries of Europe being able to compete more strongly, when you look at basically the United States being able to come into the market and overtake the market share that Europe would cede to others, I would hope that would really push the saner voices. Whether or not that will happen, I think, is going to be played out in the next 3 years due to the upcoming elections in basically the central fulcrum of the European Union, France and Germany. But I think that perhaps the Netherlands will also come in with a much saner voice. And I just hope that their voices are going to be loud enough to be heard.
And that concludes this episode of Consumer. Thank you so much for listening and subscribing. You can follow Kerry Halfaty Hardy on Twitter at KH Hardy. As always, I'm your host, Bill Wirtz. See you Thursday. You have-